Our reading this morning is from the subject of our service today and touches on his ambivalence with celebrity, his own and others. This is paraphrased from the memoirs of Dr. Joseph Priestley. What I have known of myself has tended to lessen both my admiration and my contempt of others. Could we have entered into the mind of Sir Isaac Newton and have traced all the steps by which he produced his great works, we might see nothing very extraordinary in that process. For this reason, our admiration of philosophers and writers is often lessened by a personal knowledge of them. One of the deepest challenges of being a seeker is to be both present in this current moment, open to all that is wonderful and awful happening now, and knowledgeable about our past that has made us who we are and brought us to this day. Having returned not long ago from a visit to Hungary, I've been reflecting on this dilemma, beginning when I was at an international congress there on the history of science and technology. My own work on the history of Darwin's ideas has brought me into contact with the same questions again and again. How much of an organism's being is the permanent stamp of its genetic inheritance? And how much is developed in response to the world around it and to its need to survive? I was in good company as I puzzled through these issues, as 1,300 scholars had gathered there in Budapest to make sense of how we talk about the past and how we draw upon our history to make sense of the present. Each day was too full with lectures and ideas and hurried conversations over coffee, and by the end of the week I was just overwhelmed intellectually. After the conference, several of us from the University of Wisconsin's Department of the History of Science spent the day on Margaret Island, in the middle of the Danube River, which runs through Budapest. The island is about the size of downtown Oconomowoc and is filled with sculptured gardens, cafes, and outdoor activities. Escaping the 100-plus degree weather on a shady plot of grass, we unpacked a picnic lunch and talked over our sandwiches. Moira, the wife of one of my professors, had been wanting to ask me a few questions about Unitarian Universalism, starting with, "So, are you guys Christians? I can't really tell." I explained that the origins of Unitarianism and Universalism were Christian, stretching back to the radical wing of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, but that liberal religion's willingness to evolve as times changed had turned us into something very different. After opening our doors to non-Christians in the early 20th century and offering a congenial home to humanists and other skeptics, we had arrived at the present day with a mix of theologies, including Christianity. Of course, this kind of inclusiveness made us a little unusual among congregations, since ours would be made up of people with different beliefs rather than people who are all of the same one. Paul, a recent graduate of our program, mused, "But I think that that would make it difficult to describe who you are if your identities are all over the map." I agreed that we do find it challenging to come to an agreement about who we are and who we're not, but that we tend to attract people who appreciate diversity and enjoy working through life's questions in a diverse community, rather than one where everyone is required or expected to come to the same answer. I added that one advantage of our willingness to evolve is that we're generally able to be more responsive to changing circumstances. Unlike more traditional religions, which have trouble addressing modern issues, because their theological and moral foundations are based on ancient cultures, we've not shied away from contemporary issues such as changing gender roles, new understanding about human sexuality, ever-increasing contact with other cultures, and the appearance of new technologies and their challenges. we've practically always been able to respond quickly and meaningfully to new developments because our movement's identity has evolved to respond to these modern needs. I also thought about saying, but didn't, that the downside of this is that Unitarian Universalists sometimes seem to pursue change just for the sake of novelty, and that we forget that we also have a strong and meaningful history as a movement of seekers. Because so many of us have come to this movement as adults and have the experience of it being new to us, we assume that it's new to the world. But Paul was right. We are constantly seeking some way of interpreting all of our diverse paths into a unified meaning, a unified message of a clear identity. Facing new problems with integrity is one of the reasons that I most like to talk about our movement's history. Looking to the past makes available to us now stories of women and men whose lives were lessons in insight, courage, persistence, and compassion. And these historical figures have become part of the spiritual toolbox that I carry with me to help me live according to my values. I had the opportunity to think more about our heroes this summer when the editor of the Unitarian Universalist World, our denomination's magazine, invited me to review a couple of new books about Unitarian minister and scientist Joseph Priestley. Most people remember Priestley as one of the discoverers of oxygen, as well as a number of other gases, but that's actually only a tiny part of his legacy. He had so many interests and skills that we actually have difficulty telling his whole story. If we portray him primarily as a scientist, we easily overlook the importance of his radical religious and political views, which you'll hear in a moment made him briefly, quote, the most hated man in Britain, unquote. If we look at his life through the lens of Unitarian history, we usually filter out his work as one of the fathers of chemistry, a political philosopher, and a historian. Priestley lived in a time when most of these professions and disciplines were still being defined, and it's difficult for us today to force him into our modern categories. Projecting modern expectations onto the past is a way of distorting history that we call presentism. And this narrow sort of interpretation has kept us from appreciating fully the multifaceted and accomplished person that Priestley was. The time of his childhood coincided with a period in which the Church of England was demanding ever greater conformity to its teachings, and those who didn't cooperate could be barred from civil employment or election to office. A variety of Protestant churches refused to conform to these doctrines, and we call them collectively the dissenting movements. Priestley himself grew up in a dissenting family and attended a dissenting academy as a young man, and so he was exposed to many controversial questions and became accustomed to asking difficult questions himself, as I imagine the young people in our religious education programs grew up being able to pose some unusually pointed and challenging questions to their parents. Despite being plagued with a persistent stutter, he pursued a career as a minister, and his further theological studies only deepened his skepticism about the foundations of Christianity, as well as deepening his commitment to applying reason to the questions of faith. The same tenacity and insightfulness that Priestley brought to religious questioning, he also applied to the scientific world. While serving as minister and teacher in the English towns of Nantwich and then Warrington, he conducted experiments, often as demonstrations for the public, and was encouraged by Benjamin Franklin to write a history of electricity. His studies and experimentation led him next to the exploration of gases, which scientists then classified as different kinds of air, as the understanding of a chemical element had not yet developed. It was in this area of research that Priestley is best remembered, but he also committed a fatal error that prevented him from being perhaps the celebrity he deserves to be. One of the greatest puzzles to researchers in his day was why substances are able to burn in some kinds of air but not in others. Priestley's answer was the theory of phlogiston, an invisible substance that he theorized was released when something is burning, and that once the air is filled with this phlogiston, once it's saturated, then the burning has to stop. Although this theory allowed him to explain a variety of different scientific behaviors, such as combustion, rusting, and metabolism, Priestley's commitment to it prevented him from arriving at the modern understanding, which is that oxygen is a separate element that's required for burning to happen. Another chemist, Antoine Lavoisier, was not devoted to this idea of phlogiston, and therefore he was able to understand that Priestley had really been working with oxygen all along. Therefore, it's Lavoisier who realized what it was he was working with and is credited with being the primary discoverer of this important gas. Despite Priestley's lapse on the question of oxygen, he did discover several other gases, including the technique of carbonating water with carbon dioxide, which he shared openly with anyone who was interested and wanted to do it themselves. And so next time you're enjoying a gin and tonic or a non-alcoholic soda, I invite you to raise a glass and think of Joseph Priestley and his cleverness. Throughout his life, Joseph Priestley's dissenting faith continued to be vitally important to him. And he, in fact, considered his career as a minister more important than all of the other accomplishments for which he is famous. He began to publish writings defending the rights of those liberal dissenters, but also of other dissenters, of Calvinists and even Roman Catholics, who were increasingly being considered criminals in England. When his dissenting friend Theophilus Lindsay proposed that they establish a new Christian denomination that would not demand that its members conform to a single belief, Priestley came to his aid and often preached there, also helping him to found new Unitarian chapels throughout Britain. One of the reasons that I find Joseph Priestley so fascinating is his intellectual integrity. The same foundation of reason and natural experience undergirded not only his science and his faith, but also his political vision and his defense of human rights. While philosopher John Locke believed that women and men were all endowed with the natural rights of life, liberty, and property, Locke trusted that the government would safeguard these liberties for us. Priestley, on the other hand, believed that our rights were guaranteed only if we were active participants in their protection, and that this could happen only through the creation of civil liberties, rights not only in theory, but enshrined in the pages of law. Promoting the values of democratic society was a dangerous position at that time, however. This radicalism, as well as his outspoken support of the American and French revolutions, led those in power to see Priestley increasingly as a threat to the standing order. When he compared the transformative power of reason to, quote, laying gunpowder grain by grain under the old building of error and superstition, his opponents felt justified in branding him a potential domestic terrorist. In July 1791, a mob looted and burned Priestley's home and laboratory, the Unitarian chapel where he served, two more Unitarian chapels, a Baptist meeting house, and the homes of more than two dozen congregation members. Joseph and Mary Priestley narrowly escaped with their lives, and continued threats convinced them finally to emigrate to the United States, where they lived out the rest of their lives in relative quiet. Joseph Priestley distinguished himself as an insightful and articulate minister, philosopher, scientist, political theorist, and historian, and so modern scholars are puzzled about how to categorize him. The two books about him that I reviewed approach this problem in very different ways. The more serious of the two, entitled Joseph Priestley, Scientist, Philosopher, and Theologian, handled it by bringing together seven scholars, each one evaluating Priestley from their own area of expertise. And the result of that was a very detailed and what I felt was a very complete portrait of Priestley as a whole person. The more popular book, called The Invention of Air by Stephen Johnson, was an almost textbook example of a presentist distortion of history. The author reasoned that because Priestley's work doesn't look like today's chemistry, theology, philosophy, etc., that we can consider him a sloppy dabbler and an undisciplined experimentalist. Johnson demonstrates in his book that when we expect historical figures to be evaluated by our standards rather than their own standards, we end up with a fundamental misunderstanding about the significance of our past. Both Priestley's inability to let go of a theory that no longer worked well and historians' inability to let go of an assumption about what we'll find when we look at our origins illustrate how fundamentally our assumptions can prevent us from seeing the whole picture. I saw quite a bit of this at that conference in Budapest last summer in the variety of history that we pejoratively call great man history, describing the past as a series of celebrities, intellectual or political giants who stand out fundamentally from the rest of us ordinary folk. When we tell the history of science in this way, it's like jumping along a series of stepping stones. Plato, Galileo, Newton, Einstein, Stephen Hawking, with long stretches of absolutely nothing happening in between. If you studied history in school as just a series of names and dates and places, this is the picture you came away with. In my opinion, inaccurate, and as you know, completely uninteresting. What we've come to realize is that it's not just the celebrities who have completely changed the flow of history. Lesser figures, whose work doesn't resemble our assumptions today, have also made their mark, often in ways that made it possible for those celebrities to shine. I'm fond of asking, it's in the nature of superhuman figures to do amazing things, so where's the wonder in that? Although it's harder to report, history is more accurately understood, and in my opinion, much more meaningful, when it's the story of ordinary people finding it in themselves to do extraordinary things. We might also think about this when we consider who we are as a movement and who you are as a congregation. It's easy to think that it's the most visible leaders that make the most difference, but the answer is really much more complicated than that. I'd like to think that what I say from the pulpit matters, but I know that it's really the relatively ordinary encounters between members and between members and visitors that gives this place its identity. For example, a minister or other leader may say here from the lectern that this is a welcoming and open-minded community, but if visitors find that no one greets them at coffee hour, or they receive only an awkward silence when they share what they believe or what they're most passionate about, then the official identity of our congregation is just talk. It's the relationships. It's the quality of connections between each of you that come out in your conversations, that come out in your efforts to reach out to each other and to lean upon each other, that lead people to think of this as an authentic and nurturing place. The message that I find in Priestley's story and our attempt to create meaning from his part in our history is of the importance of greeting the world with our eyes and hearts and minds wide open, that our assumptions about what we'll find won't prevent us from appreciating what's actually there. I hope that you'll be a part of helping to make this community a place of open eyes and minds and hearts, and join me in being grateful this morning also for a history that helps us understand what that kind of integrity means.